Before we get started, I just wanted to let everybody know that this podcast was recorded Thursday morning before news officially broke that the Lakers had hired JJ Redick to a four-year contract to become their new head coach. There are a few times where we mentioned JJ as a candidate for openings with the Lakers as well as the Pistons, so that is obviously out of date now. But we talked about this potential hire on last week's show. We've been talking about it since the Combine. And it's just the first big question that the Lakers need to answer this offseason. So go back and listen to that episode of No Cap Room and check yahoosports.com for more information about new Lakers head coach JJ Redick. On to the show. Hello, friends. Welcome back to No Cap Room. I am back in Brooklyn. Dan is back in his apartment. You're watching on YouTube. My name is Jake Fisher, senior NBA reporter for Yahoo Sports. And the Dan I mentioned is the Dan who's with me as always, senior NBA writer for Yahoo Sports. It's my man. It's your man. It's everyone's man. It's Dan Devine. How the hell are you?
I'm doing well, Jake. We are still in the like refractory period, let's call it, after the end of the NBA Finals. We are finding some equilibrium, but no rest for the wicked and the weary, because free agency has kind of already started and the draft is coming, and then real free agency is coming, and our, you know, wagon ride to hell continues apace. So yeah, let's keep it rocking. Let's keep the momentum going and, you know, hit it with our first post-season, our first off-season podcast. Exciting times.
It's an off-season pod, but the season don't stop. I am definitely congested. If you are listening and hear my voice sound more nasally than normal, but we've got a lot to talk about, and we're going to begin everything with a new segment to try and help set the table for podcasts moving forward. We are calling this opening segment Five Out, five basketball news stories. Maybe it's an ode to the Boston Celtics in their style.
Very, very apropos of the moment for the team that solved Five Out basketball. Now we are going to solve five off-season pieces of news every time we talk.
Man, you were like way brighter and sunnier than me. I'm going to try to match you. It's just...
Well, you know, I think, Jake, I think listeners always know that I've got the real positive vibes and that you're really bringing us all down with your Eeyore energy. So really, it's a continuation as opposed to a reversal.
Listen, man, we prioritize sleep for the first like three rounds of the playoffs, and then we had our little foster baby arugula, who is now our full-time baby, adopted.
Congratulations.
Thanks, man. She does bark though at like 7 a.m. to get it let out of the crate.
Yeah,
and that's tough for your boy. And I might have spent one night in Dallas out too late celebrating a media friend's birthday. Shout out Jared Weiss for The Athletic. Oh, but
shout out.
We're rolling. So five out. First one, definitely out. Monty Williams in Detroit.
Extremely out. Like, couldn't be more out.
He leaves with 5 years and $65+ million left on his deal. We spoke about this, if I'm remembering correctly, it was before game three in Dallas. I remember being in a hotel room. We talked about it. Yes. And said that Monty Williams' situation is still up in the air. And that's because it just was, man. Like, the word around the league was that Trajan Langdon, the new president, was leaning in the direction of keeping Monty Williams on board. And our colleague Vinny Goodwill, from his reporting and the echoes around the league, other reporting, that this decision came from ownership. So the timing is very, very, very odd.
Mm-hmm.
Like, why do this literally a week before the draft starts? I don't think a new front office wants to suddenly start a head coaching search a week before the draft, which is then like 4 days before free agency. But I think this was a long time coming.
Sure.
Basically, like, he was not going to, barring a ridiculous bounce back season, he was not going to be seeing out this Pistons contract.
Well, a couple of things. One, it's odd in the broader like universe of the NBA. But if you consider that, like, why do this and why do this now is sort of like the operative question surrounding most Detroit Pistons discussions and decisions for the last few years, like maybe it's not, maybe it's like of a piece with the way things go there. And I think one of the things that's most interesting, I know you have talked about it in the past, that Vinny wrote in his stories, like a leaked source had told him, like, there's four different factions within the Pistons, like in terms of who makes what decision, who's talking to whom, who gets final say on certain things, who, you know, what influences all those decisions. Like, it becomes so much more difficult to move in a direction when maybe everybody's paddling in their own way. And that this could certainly be part of that. I think the hope, if you are a Pistons fan, is that, or even just somebody invested in the ongoing, you know, progress of the organization, is like, this is an indicator. Trajan Langdon gets to hire his own guy. You have alignment between team president and, you know, head coach and development staff and whatever. Like, everybody can start charting the same course as opposed to working at cross purposes. But the thing that sort of blew my mind, and maybe it's a, you know, a turn of phrase or relative to what you had said, like the lean appeared to be toward bringing him back. But seeing reports that Monty Williams was blindsided by this feels wild. Like, how could this blindside you when you were just a 14-68 team that had the longest losing streak in the history of the league and was like a bottom three or five team in everything all year? And it seemed like just a real drudgery of a season. So if it surprised Monty Williams, maybe there were specific reasons why it surprised him, but I think globally it is not a surprise at all that whoever is making the decisions, and it sounds here like Tom Gores was the one that pulled the trigger on this, like, wants them to move in a direction that Monty Williams was not able to bring that team that did not seem to progress really anywhere or hardly at all during a lost season.
Yeah, I think the blind side aspect lends credence to the fact that this front office didn't necessarily want to make this change.
Right.
And if you want to spin this forward, I mean, I would not suspect Monty Williams coaches this season. As much as the word is that he would like to coach again, he didn't want to take this job to begin with, which we've discussed at length before. So can't imagine him rushing into the sidelines once again. Maybe there'll be some coaching. Maybe he'll be the next in the long line of coaching consultants that has become a trend now around the league, which we will talk about in our next bullet point on Five Out. But for now, the two names that myself and Vinny Goodwill have heard, James Borrego, who is, of course, involved in the Lakers job, to what degree seems skeptical, being that they could have hired him since May and have not extended him an offer. And there's definitely word around the league that they would prefer Borrego to be an assistant on J.J. Redick's staff if that were to come to fruition. And J.J. Redick is another name in the Pistons world right now. He went to Duke. Trajan Langdon's a Duke guy.
Always the Duke connection.
He used to work with Arntellum on the agency side of things back in the day. That being said, I don't get the sense right now, things could change. I don't get the sense that Detroit's moving quickly to solve this thing. I think the Cleveland thing will get wrapped up sooner rather than later. The idea around the league and from people familiar with the situation was that the Cavs had met with Borrego last week going into games 3 and 4 before game 5. The Monday morning of game 5 in Boston, the Cavs were hunkering down and meeting with a larger group after meeting with Borrego, then Mike Anori, then Kenny Atkinson in person. The thought was that decision could come as early as Wednesday. It's Thursday. There's no decision. Yeah. There had been some talk about maybe needing to have those candidates meet ownership. We'll see what happens. But to go back to the coaching consulting thing, bullet point number 2 of our 5 out is Celtics consultant Jeff Van Gundy is going to be leaving Champions to join Ty Lue's Clippers staff as a lead assistant, which we definitely heard some rumblings about. Mark Stein wrote that on his Substack. At first, I heard Stan Van Gundy, and then that's just the game of telephone that sometimes this intel calls are. I called Stan Van Gundy's agent. He was like, I think you're talking about Jeff. So Jeff Van Gundy back in the fold as a 62-year-old has not been in an NBA coaching job since 2007. He did do some FIBA stuff in the interim, but great for him being that by various accounts, the reasoning he was let go of ESPN was out of fear that he'd be wanting to go back into coaching again. So at least he gets the opportunity.
Yeah. And you know, you mentioned it. This is like maybe the culmination of a multi-year process where he was going, like, it's one thing to, if you're like a glitz and glamour, like high profile name, and you're like, well, I'm only going to be open to the biggest jobs possible, right? Like the more, the glamour markets, the highest pay, like here's a guy who since 2017 has been like working his way back through the Team USA program where like it's coaching the AmeriCup roster, right? Or being like an advanced scout for Pop and Steve Kerr, like the relatively unglamorous work of, but like integral coaching jobs, right? And you know, one of the questions was like, so what exactly did he do for the Celtics? And that's, you know, like it was something that came up in a couple of the interviews that he's done since the finals ended. And he's kind of he's told Zach Lowe that he played a very, very small part in the title season. But like, and the Celtics gave me more than I gave the Celtics. But Brad Stevens had said in an interview back in April, I think it was Brian Robb at MassLive.com, that it was like player enhancement stuff. He'd been working with the G League team, with the Maine Celtics, been working with their like get ready crew, like the guys who are not necessarily part of the top of the roster, the back half of the roster, to get those guys ready so that when they needed to step in, like someone like an O'Shea Brissett, you know, in going into the playoffs when they needed another body, like that those guys were ready to go to keep getting, you know, the younger guys, the Jordan Walshes and JD Davisons, like moving forward in their program, which again, like that's not stuff you generally sign up for if you're the person who's only looking at it like, I want to be, I'm trying to get my name heated up so I can be the next head coach. Like that is, I really want to get back to the coaching part of it. And I think part of that comes from just what he needed. I think this was a really interesting thing, not to keep reading other people's podcast notes, but he talked to Mark Jackson, his former ESPN colleague on Mark Jackson's new show. And he talked about like the churn of what's happened to him in the past year, where it's like almost exactly a year ago, he gets fired by ESPN. His youngest son goes to school. He and his wife are empty nesters. His sister-in-law passes away. One of his best friends from when he was in Houston contracts cancer and dies in the spring. So like he was going through a whole lot in his personal life. And it's like, well, what do we do when we are going through a ton of stuff? You go to what you know, right? And like you return to the idea of coaching to him and like losing yourself in the work and being in that a camaraderie of the staff and all that kind of stuff. He talks about it like Brad Stevens and Joe Mazzulla threw him a lifeline, like gave him an opportunity to get back to kind of center and to do that and then do it so well that then Ty Lue, with whom he'd worked for Team USA as well, like had the opportunity, had the opening, wanted to extend it. Like this is a new act in his kind of story. And I think that's pretty cool to get one of those at 62 after all that he's been through professionally and personally, and be pretty excited to actually see him on the bench next season.
From Van Gundy's champion Celtics to the champion runner-ups, the Mavericks, Mark Cuban no longer has control of basketball operations in Dallas. That's part of the new ownership situation where Patrick Dumont is now the governor and the leader of all things basketball in Dallas. So this is kind of big because Cuban has always had a leading voice. He's always had final say on everything. And doesn't seem to be the case right now as Dallas has an executive and a front office that pretty lauded around the league for the moves they made dating back to the Kyrie Irving trade and this year's deadline with PJ Washington and Daniel Gafford. Sweet minimum signing with Derek Jones Jr. So I dare say that Dallas seems to be shaping into more of a traditional organization where front office gets power and the autonomy to make decisions without a billionaire with his thumb on any type of button that he would want to press at any moment in time. So we'll see, and we'll keep our ears open to see how things change there. But to me, that is the thing of note with this. It's that there have been stories all across the league of, you know, our owner wouldn't let us do this. And it's a thing that GMs will use in negotiations as a tool. Well, I'd love to, but my owner won't let me.
Right.
So It'll just be interesting to hear how things change, especially with, you know, as we talked about on our last episode, the only real thing that Dallas has to look at this summer is figuring out the Derek Jones Jr. contract and how much space they're going to need to make that happen. So they don't have a ton of pressing needs to do it right now. But as things move forward, as we get to the trade deadline and maybe things don't go as planned or what have you, it'll just be interesting to follow.
Yeah, I think the Nico Harrison getting this, like, there was already the vote of confidence in sort of implied in the mid playoff run contract extension that he received, right? So it's like where clearly the powers that be there feel pretty comfortable with him, the job that he's doing, the decisions that he's making, the way he was able to remake that roster. And that's one of the things, you know, throughout the playoffs, Jason Kidd and Luka Doncic and Kyrie Irving, everybody kept talking about, like, we've only been together like 5 months, you know? So there's this feeling of this, like the big structural work has been done and they're moving in. They're able to move from there. I think you mentioned the Derek Jones Jr. contract. There's also just it's not necessarily a have to question, but a potential as you keep looking for opportunities to improve the roster. Once you get to draft night, they'll open up, I think, two future firsts that they can use, 2025 and 2031. If they want to be able to use those in trade, that plus the Tim Hardaway Jr. contract. We've talked about that, whether they actually do anything with that or do anything with that in the offseason, or if that's an in-season kind of thing, it at least, that's sort of maybe the next transactional domino to fall, or potential, you know, pathway that Nico Harrison and company can go down. But I think you're absolutely right. Like, for a generation, Mark Cuban has been like, has really wielded that public image. Like, I'm the decider. I'm the one who's going to like lead us in whatever direction we go. And it's going to be a little bit odd to not have that, you know, maybe he's still on the sideline in a jersey or whatever, but like to know that he's not the one with final say or the one where the buck stops with him. It'll be interesting to see how that changes or in what, if it changes at all, the way the organization moves. But I mean, you got to say, like, they've moved in a better direction in the last 18 months than they had in a number of years before that, with Cuban being the one who had the final say on those decisions and the rotating front office they've had around that. So, I think still a lot to be excited about in Dallas, although you're right to say, like, it'll be kind of fascinating to figure out what actually changes as a result.
Our fourth item here on Five Out, Joe Mazzulla revealed that he coached the Celtics to an NBA championship on a torn meniscus. So that means we have two NBA coaches who were in the conference finals, shout out Chris Finch, with a knee injury. So Mazzulla's quote, "I got to have knee surgery. Tore my meniscus in March after we lost to Atlanta. Going to be out a little while. I've been working through it since March." So they had back-to-back losses in Atlanta. It was 2 weeks after Mazzulla tried to block a Royce O'Neal shot after a timeout. Just shout out Joe Mazzulla. I mean, he's the weirdest dude to ever man the number one spot on a bench. But you got to own your weird. You got to be authentic. There's too many people in the NBA. I actually texted someone this week something to the effect of authenticity, clap, 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 clap. Because there's too many people in the NBA who are stunting and performing and they're not true to who they are. And it's a problem. And it causes problems in locker rooms and in front offices and blah, blah, blah. I want Joe Mazzulla to stand as an example for people across the league to lean into your quirks if it's true. And if you really do think, I mean, so I'm seeing a clip on Twitter this morning of him on Zach Lowe's podcast saying that he would want to be, this was in relation to his love for the movie The Town, saying that he'd either want to be the mastermind who organizes everything so everyone's prepared, it's all about preparation, or the one with steady hands to crack the safe.
Yeah.
Like, lean into who you are and just rely on those principles, man. I love it.
I've
turned from the biggest skeptic to the biggest believer. Shout out Joe Mazzulla.
I mean, I can well, first off, I think it's good that you're owning your flip flopping on this issue. I think I respect that a lot.
Oh, yeah.
But I also, like, you can own your weird and lean into your quirks and, you know, turn the volume up to 11 when you're good. If Joe Mazzulla was coaching, if the record was 14-68 with the 28 game losing streak for Joe Mazzulla, I don't think him being like, so here's the secrets that I learned in the jungles of Costa Rica.
Or are they good in large part due to.
I mean, they were pretty good before he got to the head coaching job. They were pretty good under two other head coaches also. And then since they had those guys, they added Drew Holiday and Kristaps Porzingis. So I don't know. I think it's like, not to say that Joe Mazzulla is a creation of those guys. Those guys throughout the postseason run were like, he is a genius. He is somebody that we feel super confident leading us, et cetera, et cetera. I would just say though, like, you get it when you're, it's like that old joke, like, you know, when you're poor, you're crazy. When you're rich, you're eccentric. Like Joe Mazzulla gets to be quirky because they just won the whole thing. And they were really good even when they didn't win. Like, they got into the conference finals last year. And even that, they made the conference finals last year with the quirks, and he was raked over the coals because they didn't win. Right. So, you know, but that said, you get to enjoy it. To the victor goes the spoils, and those spoils can include, you know, planning out your heist crew with podcasters. The other thing I would say, though, is what my favorite part of it is after, like, the next thing Joe Mazzulla said after he says, like, I tore my meniscus, I'm going to need surgery, is like, first things first, I got to get back on the mats. So, like, priority one, as soon as you're healthy, rolling Brazilian jiu-jitsu. Let that be a lesson, everybody. Like, yes, it's important to get back on the whiteboard. It's important to think about what you can do to further optimize your five-out offense and your switch-heavy defense. But really, job one is you got to get out there and start working on your submission game again.
What's your version of getting back to the mats, Dan?
Well, it's definitely not going to be rolling Brazilian jiu-jitsu. I think that's that. I don't have the facility for that. My version of getting back to the mats, well, I mean, after I have my off-season surgery, is probably going to be. I actually do have to get my shoulder checked out. I've had a messed up left shoulder for a while, and I wanted to get a referral to get somebody to look at it. But my primary care said I got to go to him first. So it's a whole thing. I don't know when it's going to happen.
It's a whole thing.
But honestly, getting back to the mats for me right now is like watching Drag Race with my wife, like watching RuPaul's Drag Race. It is a wonderful off ramp from the NBA season for me. And that's the way I'm spending my nights.
Like your own wellness, fitness, health routine.
Dude, but that's okay. I don't have a wellness, fitness, health routine. I just kind of keep deteriorating. And we've been doing this for about almost 15 years. And we're just going to see how long we can keep it going. The downward spiral continues.
And for me, it's biking. Get on the two wheels, hit the bike lanes.
Stay safe, beloved. It's tough out there biking in these streets of Brooklyn.
Knock on wood. Only had one fall so far. I don't know if I've ever told this story. It was like either the day of the draft or free agency starting. My first year at Bleacher Report, things were going well. Phone was blowing up. I remember I put on my brightest outfit possible. I was like, it would really suck to get hit by a car right now. I was like, I'm about to like land the plane on this career climb I've been trying to do for a decade. And I must have jinxed it, but I was going west down to Cobb Avenue on the way to the Prospect Park. And there was a car in the bike lane with its hatters on. Cars, do not park in the bike lane. You should get ticketed. Should be a thing.
Yeah, sometimes you got to drop the kids off the camp. You know what I'm saying? Like, it's a tough decision to go around it.
Looked over the shoulder to see if there's any traffic coming. Tire got caught in a manhole, flipped, ended up on my back as a car is coming, yelling, "Stop! Stop!" So we're fine. But
so you said, man, it would be a really bad time to get. What's a good time for you to get hit by a car, Jake?
Like after you've created some type of wealth for your family to live off of.
Fair point.
in your deceased-dom. Anyway,
deceased-dom.
last item of five out, swinging the ball to the corner. Rich Paul went on the record with ESPN's Jonathan Gaboni and listed the five teams that they think he's going to go to.
Think who's going to go to?
Sorry, Bronny James.
There it is.
One, LeBron James Jr.
Call that a hockey assist, the extra pass.
And look, I've talked to Rich about this as well. His whole thing from the jump has been, I've done this before. I did this with Brandon Boston Jr. with the Clippers. I did this with Chris Livingston. That they care more about fit and situation than they do about how high he goes. There's certain, I mean, every agency does things differently. Like right now, all this word that Atlanta is not a situation that WME wants Alex Saar, the top prospect out of Australia, out of Perth, Australia, who's French. He played at several different places, went to Overtime Elite. they don't want him to be a member of the Hawks, which like could cost them $9 million in theory over the course of 4 years. But it's all about that second contract. It's all about fit, blah, blah, blah. Rich Paul has said to me, he views Bronny James as like some type of like Eric Bledsoe back in the Clippers or TJ McConnell right now with the Pacers. This is what he said. And Peyton Pritchard with Boston, like a guard that has win now capabilities, high IQ, thinks the game, that has room to grow, but is ready to contribute right now to a winning postseason team. So all the teams that they mentioned, that Rich Paul mentioned, Lakers, Suns, and James Jones, very close confidant of LeBron James, and they won titles together, now the GM of Phoenix. The Suns have a clear, absolute need of a guard defender who can just spread the floor and get everyone into their offense. And there's an opportunity for Phoenix to potentially trade down from the 22nd pick, pick up some assets and still potentially take him, or, you know, he could wait till the second round. Minnesota, another spot they mentioned, obvious playoff team. Dallas down all the way at 58. The Mavericks don't think he'll be there, but Nico Harrison, longtime Nike executive, close connection with the James family. Last one, Toronto is not a playoff situation, but they already kind of had their makings of Mano Quickly up for a huge contract. By all accounts, he will be signing one with Toronto. Scotty Barnes, potential for a big rookie extension as well. Young group for him to grow with. So that's been the word from Rich's mouth, from the overall clutch team all along about Bronny, is that they are trying to manipulate his situation to put him in particular teams that they think are good for him as an individual to grow within. So that's all I got. Any thoughts from you?
Yeah, I mean, there's the Eli Manning won't go to the Chargers, he'll only go to the Giants kind of thing, like Archie Manning trying to coordinate that, you know, whatever, 20 odd years ago in the NFL. Like, you wonder if this is, I mean, it's a unique situation because the son of LeBron James is a unique prospect, right? Even if he's not unique in terms of overall skill set and potential impact, like the names that you are mentioning are, you know, it's a third guard rotation player who can be a positive contributor, not like this guy's going to be a 15-time All-Star, but it's a unique situation because no player in the modern history of the game has ever been able to exert influence in the way that LeBron James has and can. So like, it's interesting in that way. And I don't know that it's going to be a replicable formula for future sons of current stars or whatever, but like, that'll be interesting to monitor and see if that's the case. But I think a lot of it is just like, this is sort of, it's agenting, right? It's what every agent, given the opportunity, given the leverage, given the stroke, wants to control the process as much as possible. This is why the NBA, like the CBA had to be, or it was included in the last CBA, like you kind of can't withhold medicals from certain teams. Like, as many potential avenues as there are to controlling the process and routing your guys where you want them for fit or for guaranteed deal or to avoid being stuck on a two-way where you're not going to get developmental time, or being stuck in the second round where you're not going to get the full four-year guaranteed contract. Or if you get one, it's going to be like the Hinkie special where it's like lower money without years and yada, yada, yada. Like, every agent that has the opportunity to do this, you know, to chart the path will take whatever, you know, use whatever leverage is at their disposal to do it. Clutch just happens to be one that has a ton of leverage. Rich Paul is somebody that has a ton of leverage, and the specific framework for LeBron's son is going to be even more so than that. But yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting to think about. Like, it's funny to me, or not funny, it's interesting that this process has already sort of started with like what we anticipate Bronny James being is, you know, on the high side, like what, like rookie or first, second year Eric Bledsoe was, or, you know, the idea is rotation guard, like that is the goal. Like, but like eighth guy, seventh guy, like that's sort of the goal.
Yeah.
And so I think that's like, if the agency is telling you that, I think that's, you know, whatever attention that we devote to him is probably, we should recalibrate along those lines. I think maybe the most interesting thing from that interview with Jonathan Givony, shouts out to Jonathan, is this. Quote, LeBron is off this idea of having to play with Bronny. If he does, he does. But if he doesn't, he doesn't. There's no deal
They've
made.
They've been saying that since the combine.
Yeah. So, but it's on the record. It's out in for, you know, sort of in public and, you know, the week before the draft. So like he's off that. It's not happening. You know, LeBron's not going to Phoenix for a minimum deal. We can squash that now. So they're not connected. It's not a package deal. And whenever, you know, whoever's going after Bronny James probably knows that what they're getting is at best a rotation caliber, you know, end of the rotation caliber player. And that's probably something worth keeping in mind.
Yeah. He's not going to Phoenix on a minimum. He is going to be making a lot of money and it just might not be with the Sun. That's it for Five Out. What comes next around the league, just to update our listeners before we take an ad break, the draft next week. First time we have a two-night draft, June 26th and June 27th.
Which is good because we've been trying to stretch this out. There's not enough days that are covered with NBA happenings, and we got to really expand.
Media day will be Tuesday before that. I'll be there. Vinny will be here. Vinny will be at the draft. I will not be at the draft. I like to do the draft from home where I can text and call and blah, blah, blah. Kristen Peek will do an on-the-clock after round one completes on Wednesday night.
Shouts out to Kristen. Man. She's grinding right now. She's like, it's shows and articles and columns and everything. She's got a ton coming out these days. So check her out. All her work at Yahoo Sports.
There will be a no cap room on Friday, but I'm just going to throw it out there. As we're recording, we could in theory do it Thursday night because the draft second round starts only 4 o'clock in the afternoon on Thursday. So there is possibility. I'm just throwing that out.
It's an off the mic conversation.
Our team.
Let's work that out.
It's off the mic conversation. NBA free agency officially begins June 30th on Sunday at 6 p.m. Eastern. Then we've got Summer League, July 12th to the 22nd. I'll be there. Vinny will be there as well. Team USA men's basketball will begin the Paris Olympics, July 27th. And then the WNBA trade deadline, August 20th. So that is the calendar up ahead. We'll take a quick break for some ads. And then we'll be right back to talk about the unofficial start of NBA free agency. Welcome back to No Cap Room here on the Ball Don't Lie podcast. Free agency officially starts for everyone June 30th, 6 p.m. But after the finals ended on Monday night, starting 12:01 Eastern Time Tuesday, teams were eligible to start negotiating with their own free agents. We got the first deal, which was expected to be the first deal, I think, around the league. Pascal Siakam, 4-year max contract to stay with the Pacers. The next one, I think, and the way these things all get signed and the order of it will be important for the cap gymnastics of teams. I think the next one everyone's looking at is Tyrese Maxey's extension in Philly. One thing I will say, after some calls this week, you know, the league, which is representing the teams in the terms of the two sides negotiating the CBA, the league was the one, from my understanding, to push this item across the agenda of having this early negotiation window for teams with their own free agents. It kind of seems the early returns, it kind of seems like this actually is negatively impacting the team side of things. Because the way this used to work, you look at PJ Washington as recently as last summer when he was still with Charlotte. Think back to Larry Markkanen when he was on the open market in Chicago. His was a restricted thing, so that was more complicated. But in general, teams always had the ability previously to say, hey, if you think you're worth $20 million, I'm just throwing out a random number, go out to the market. If you can go get that, great. Bring it back. We will take it. Not exactly like how it's technically supposed to work when you're unrestricted free agent. But if a player wants to stay and a team wants to bring the player back, but they're just not seeing eye to eye on numbers, that's typically how things have gone. Now, know, if you're Nick Claxton in Brooklyn, and everyone throughout your time there with the Nets has said, oh, we love you, we want to keep you. So, okay, well, then show me the money.
Yeah.
And if they're not, which the word right now is that they are not necessarily locked in there, although I do expect Nick Claxton to remain in Brooklyn, it just puts teams in a worse position than they had to be previously. Like, the Lakers need to wait, in theory, to offer certain numbers depending on how much space they'll have, depending on what D'Angelo Russell does with his player option. LeBron, by all intents and purposes, we're expecting to go back to LA, but like, he still has a player option decision he hasn't made yet. There's all these things. Paul George, even, like, from a certain extent, will impact. Like, if the Clippers want to extend someone such as Ivica Zubac, they will only have certain numbers to play with depending on what that dude does. So it's just interesting to me that everyone was talking about, oh, Frazier is going to start early. It's going to be all these deals coming in. And it seems like this thing actually is hurting teams more so than it's helping them.
I mean, it wouldn't be the first instance of unintended consequences coming from a, you know, tweak to the CBA or a league shift in the mandate to come down the pike here. I mean, if the idea was in part like, let's make this okay so that we don't have to, like, we don't want to have to smack you around for tampering later, or we don't want to have to, you know, we don't want to have to, like, or like, we want more to be able to talk about, like, actually stuff to, you know, the transactions that can be lead on a show or whatever, like, to actually be, you know, fodder for discussion in the days between the end of the finals and the draft. Like, I get it. But yeah, if I mean, to some degree, though, like, I kind of, that's the world's smallest violin for the teams. Like, you like, it's up to you to make that player understand why, or show that player the money, right? Or like, get the deal done in advance. Like, if the Maxi point or the Paul George point, I think those are interesting. I think everyone expects the Maxi deal to happen, but it knows that it needs to happen as, like, order of operations wise after Philly fills up the rest of its cap space, right? And then, like, you go over the top to bring him back. So I don't think anybody's like, well, is that going to engender bad faith or anything like that? But with Paul George, yeah, like, you can't get anything else done until you know if he's going or not, and he can't negotiate with anybody else yet. So, and based on everything we've heard before that, like, if the Clippers were willing to go full boat max on Paul George, this probably would have been done a while ago. So,
oh yeah,
if you know, like, the terms of engagement have not changed, it creates more opportunity for noses to get out of joint about it. But you know, if you didn't want that,
then you said noses to get out of joint.
Yeah, that's an old timey phrase. You're not familiar with that?
Never heard that. Get your nose out of joint. You said many old timey phrases on this pod. That's definitely one I've never heard before.
I mean, do you Google Jake Fisher? It's a real thing. Yeah. Get your nose out of joint. Like,
I'm not saying you're wrong. I'm saying I'm learning.
It's maybe as old timey as the Brooklyn Dodgers hat on your head right now. It might stretch back to the 40s and 50s. In the sort of thing, like a Miassi gangster would say, hat. Your nose out of joint. In any event, whether the early start is a good thing or a bad thing for teams, I think, you know, we'll see over the course of time if it has any impact. But what is definitely going to have some impact is what some of these top names decide they want to do when actual free agency opens.
For sure. I think every free agency period, to me, the way I've always described it since I've been doing this stuff, there are always big dominoes that have to fall because things overlap at typically a positional level, but also from a this team has cap space level. I think there's really two big ones this year. And the wing market starts with Paul George. The center market starts with Isaiah Hartenstein. The Paul George thing, as you mentioned, Dan, we've discussed, we've written about. I don't have as up-to-date information as admittedly I would like to, as we record this at just before noon on Thursday, June 20th. But the word still has been for weeks and months now that the Clippers are not willing to go above the 3-year 153 that they extended Kawhi this past season for anyone, not Paul George, not James Harden, that they are projecting to their own agents of their clients, which they are allowed to do right now, that they are not willing to go above 3 years for anyone, let alone the numbers. So that is what has lent credence to the threats of Philadelphia, for one, to lavish Paul George with a 4-year max. The thought, though, is that Paul George does not want to leave LA. He wanted to go to LA, dating back to when he was with the Pacers. And even though he had a stopover with OKC and re-signed there, he went to LA. His parents sit courtside at every game. He's announced from Palmdale. Is that his hometown? Yeah, I forgot. I'm sorry. As opposed to from Fresno State. LA dude, living it up. Happy to be home. We'll see. This is a big staring contest. But whatever he does has all these impacts. The most direct one is Philly.
Yeah.
Because he's their banner A option. The Sixers would prefer to use their space. They have upwards of $60 million. They want to use their space on someone as opposed to having to mortgage draft capital to add someone, because they would like to keep that draft capital to further add once they were to bring a third star next to Tyrese Maxey and next to Joel Embiid. So who is being held up? What other dominoes are being held up by that, you may be asking? All the wings, from Klay Thompson to Kentavious Caldwell-Pope, Miles Bridges. Those are like the biggest names, I would say, at this juncture. OG Anunoby as well. His situation's also looped into the Paul George thing, because he is someone on Philly's list that they could go and use that cap space for. He is someone that potentially could be sent out of New York if the Knicks were to make a move at Paul George. So there's all these overlapping circles that will impact one another. And it really does come down to just what does Paul George do for a lot of this stuff. The secondary things will swing. I don't know what to say to swing this over to you, Dan, but I guess I'll say, what is your reaction to that?
Well, to be honest, my first reaction when you sort of described the dominoes in the wing market and you said, you know, what Philly does will impact Klay Thompson. My first thought was, is Klay Thompson somebody that Philly's keeping an eye on? Because that, like,
yeah. Oh, yeah.
Because that,
we wrote that in wherever we did it, in the big Paul George Sixers stuff that we discussed. He's on their list of backup options.
Right.
Yeah.
Which, so for whatever reason, that maybe I just forgot that because the last couple of months have been such a sinkhole for my brain. But like the idea that we'll get to the Warriors when we get to the Warriors. But like when I think of it's like, what would the hope be for Klay Thompson? It's like if Buddy Hield actually shot fast, is that sort of the idea of what they would be looking for? You know, like we continue to look for a wing that can do some of the handoff stuff with Joel, who can be the floor spacer, but is actually like, you know, accurate, high volume and quick with it. And so I think that's interesting to me from an on-court perspective, but also you wonder, like, Klay, with the step he's lost, totally understandably, due to the injuries that he's dealt with defensively, like, where does he fit in to what Philly wants to be there and what, you know, Nick Nurse wants that team to be. So I think that's interesting to me. Just I started sort of spinning my wheels on what on court that looks like before we even get to the point of like, can I even imagine literally what it would look like to see Klay Thompson in a different uniform, which is, I think, something that we're increasingly having to get our minds around a little bit, which is kind of wild.
Yeah, we'll get to that in the Warriors section, because there's plenty to talk about with Golden State.
I guess before we go further, you're asking like, when, where does my mind go next? Is the Anunoby and Hartenstein being like pivot points in the market, right? I know you had written that there's probably more suitors than you might have anticipated for Isaiah Hartenstein, especially coming off the sort of fantastic postseason run that he had. I guess the question, as we sort of handicap moving into the free agency period, is like, how significant of flight risks would you say that those guys look like they are for New York at this point?
Depends on who you talk to.
Mm-hmm.
You talk to certain people, they'll say OG Anunoby has wanted a larger offensive role dating back to his time in Toronto, and getting to New York, he has been a little miffed by being like the fourth banana to the Villanova triumvirate And that's before Julius Randle comes back from injury. And then there's the money stuff where allegedly, I mean, the Knicks have gotten, and there's all the CAA Knicks stuff. And like, Knicks have gotten a lot of team-friendly deals from CAA clients. Doesn't seem like that's something OG Anunoby wants to do. So is there more money out there for him? If Paul George isn't available, I definitely think the money's going to be there from Philly. Other scenarios, I can't speak so confidently about publicly right now, but he's someone that plenty of teams have wanted in the past. If you want to talk about Portland dating back to the Dame Lillard stuff and even after, and could there be something with Sacramento and, you know, down the line, like he's a player that in theory plugs and plays into any wannabe contender, just like he did with New York. And if it comes to the sign and trade scenario, who's to say what could open up there? So the one thing that's curious, like when I talk about Hartenstein, like he is the best center on the board. So number one, like if you're looking and you're swinging, you're trying to get the best center available. If you don't get him, that just is a ripple effect, domino effect that we're discussing here.
Which also maybe complicates the Nick Claxton situation, right? Like as an unrestricted 100%. Guy, like who has had, you know, made like all defense caliber, you know, stats and impact at different points and was a really integral part of when those Nets teams were good. You know, you could see why, like you could see him maybe waiting and seeing if somebody strikes out on Hartenstein, like wants to show him the money.
100%. If you're Nick Claxton and you think you should be getting $100 million, which is in the range that I have been told they're looking for, the upwards of that range. But let's say the Nets say, well, you know what? We're more thinking your Jakob Poeltl money, 4 years, 80. What's stopping Nick Claxton from sitting back and waiting for Isaiah Hartenstein to potentially go back to New York and all of a sudden he's the bell of the ball?
Yeah.
You know, the one big spot that everyone mentions for Hartenstein is OKC. And there's talk of a 2 year big type money, like Brook Lopez type contract that he just signed in Milwaukee last season that will be available potentially for Hartenstein, which people always say it's so hard to find out what OKC's doing. They send out smoke screens and blah, blah, blah. Like 2 years ago, everyone heard, maybe it wasn't 2 years ago, whatever year it's Spencer Dinwiddie was on the market and he ends up signing with Washington and turns to a five-team sign and trade. There was all this, I think that was 2021, I want to say correctly. So 3 years ago, there was all this talk of, oh, Dinwiddie could be getting a massive 2 year balloon deal from OKC. Everyone's like, oh, who's to know if that's true? Like that, for my accounting, was accurate. Last year, OKC was a team that was in the mix for Bruce Brown. And they did make a big offer to Bruce Brown before he signed with Indiana. So that was true too. So there's two recent examples of big short-term money deals that OKC was rumored to potentially do that they actually absolutely got in the mix for. They didn't sign either of them, but they got in the mix for. So they've been linked to Claxton as well and a potential sign and trade spot for, or just a potential spot for Patrick Williams and so on and so forth. They can't, I mean, they have $35 million in space. So they could, in theory, sign two guys, right? Like if they want to give a $23 million a year balloon payment to someone, they could still have 10 left over. But they can't pay that $20 million plus to all these dudes. So the Thunder are also a big domino in this and where that space goes, because they're one other team, just like Philly, that is good, that is a legit contender, that actually has wiggle room to do something big. And they're someone that rival execs have been looking at to capitalize before you got to pay all your guys, and they haven't yet. So this is a period that I think a lot of teams are looking and waiting to see if they actually do something with it.
That's the dot that I keep connecting there is I'm like, well, where was Oklahoma City short in the playoffs and which guy fits into that space? And I'm like, well, if you had a four who could defend and shoot that teams had to respect, that they couldn't sag off of. I'm like, how do we get, how does OG Anunoby get to Oklahoma City? Is, I think that's the dot to connect to me, where I'm like, that's the, I mean, if there's like a stalking horse team, and maybe that's just, you know, that's me playing fantasy basketball, or, you know, 2K roster construction. But like, if you, and it's also why I would imagine, if I'm OG Anunoby's representatives, I'm saying, we're not just necessarily going to jump at the first offer, because there's a couple of teams that actually do have pretty big money to spend that are, that also satisfy our, we want to play for championships, we want to be in big competitive situations, whether he wants to be in Oklahoma City or Philly or anywhere else, who knows. But that, like, from a basketball perspective, the thing that Oklahoma City was missing is the thing that that guy does great, and would, you know, turns a team that has one Achilles heel into one that might be a little bit closer to solved. So I don't know. Yeah, I think what happens with, like, obviously we're here in New York. I have ancestral lineage as a Knicks fan. I'm going to be paying attention to what the Knicks do there. But I also think the guys specifically that are on the market from them, and that the teams that could go and try to like reorganize with those guys, I think that that's pretty fascinating to me. And Anunoby, also Anunoby coming off the injury, which was also part of the reason why he didn't maybe get all those long-term offers in Toronto and yada, yada, yada. Like, there's a lot to sort of figure out there.
One last domino I want to highlight, just because I think it's sneaky. DeMar DeRozan in Chicago.
Yeah, what the hell do you do with him?
I believe, as I consulted with someone yesterday, he can only sign a 3-year deal because of the over 38 rule.
Mm-hmm.
His contract, it's been described as something that will set the tone and a barometer for whatever deal James Harden will sign with the Clippers. Because I think the Clippers want him back. I think he wants to stay there. And I don't think there's anyone else who's going to come close to the type of money that will exist for Harden
with the Clippers. That's literally my notes on Harden, is like, seems pretty obvious. He wants to be in LA. They don't want to lose him. They can't replace him. So it's just a question of dollar sign and how comfortable he is with a haircut.
The thing with DeMar too is, like, you hear two things about Chicago right now. That they're trying to bring DeMar back, and that they're also trying to be very active, and their roster is not going to look anything like it was this year, even though they haven't traded a human being in 3 years. So both those two things can't be true at the same time. Alex Caruso's had a ton of interest on the trade market from everyone the last couple of years. Patrick Williams is a name we mentioned earlier, who has all the upside in the world, number 4 pick in the 2020 draft, and just hasn't been healthy enough, hasn't strung together enough consistency to maximize that yet. Still super young, though. He's drafted at, I think, he was the youngest guy in the league at 19 years old, youngest guy in the draft that year. But there's plenty of talk about there being potential interest from Toronto and him being a possible backup in Charlotte, depending on what happens at Miles Bridges. And like we said, he's another name on the OKC rumor mill. So what happens with him will be an interesting inflection point. Lonzo Ball saying he's coming back.
I hope so. I mean, would love to see it. It's been an awful long time since we saw that dude run. It'd be cool to see him do it.
Yeah. So it's just, there's plenty of stuff at stake in Chicago while they're also trying to move Zach LaVine. And to me, it just, how much money is on the books for DeMar and for how long into the future is going to be a massive chunk of their cap sheet. That's going to help determine a lot of their other stuff they're trying to do. So that's the last one I wanted to highlight.
Yeah, I just, with him too, I think and this is admittedly maybe a failure of imagination on my part, because I'm like, if not there, if there isn't money there, or if they decide to go in a different direction, or if he doesn't like what they're offering or whatever, where does DeMar DeRozan fit naturally, right? Like, you don't imagine DeMar DeRozan is going to want to go to a team that, you know, isn't close to competing or contending. You know, he's just done sort of his intervening years at a place that doesn't have a whole lot. I mean, before that it was San Antonio, where they were not really competitive outside of that, you know, that 1 year where they played Denver in the first round. Like, you'd imagine someone getting towards the end of his career, who's already made quite a bit of money in the league, who missed out on the title year in Toronto because he was the piece that went out to bring Kawhi Leonard there, so that they, you know, like, you'd imagine he wants that opportunity, deep playoff runs again. But like, where does he fit? Because, you know, I know there had been dots connected with Philly in the past, but like, in terms of the shooting component and being a third offensive piece next to between Embiid and Maxey, does he provide on the defensive end what you would want from that kind of piece? It's not as clean a fit as someone like George or even Anunoby might be. Like it's a little bit tricky to find a place that is both close enough to contending and would have the money to spend on him that also would provide a role commensurate with his esteem and reputation, but also wouldn't be like compromised to some degree by the holes in his game. He's an interesting guy to try to figure out where he fits, and I don't feel like I've got a good answer for it.
I think a lot of people are waiting to find that answer as well. Our last segment of the show, before I blow my nose and try to make more phone calls, we are going to vibe check the Golden State Warriors. The vibes have not been so high out in the Bay. They still got the four rings. They still got Steph Curry. They still got Draymond Green. They still got Steve Kerr. Everything else outside of Gary Payton Jr. picking up his option. $9.1 million player option for Gary Payton next season. It gives Warriors the flexibility to extend him this offseason. I'm not so certain that's so guaranteed. Because another guy who's had injury stuff throughout the last couple of years would stand to potentially benefit being healthy, playing a full, not 82, but, you know, full season and getting back out in the market with that under his resume. But they got a lot of questions. They are already expected to be paying the most in luxury tax for next season as things stand. They just paid an estimated $177 million just to miss the playoffs. Biggest thing for sure is the Klay Thompson stuff, which at this juncture, I am starting to be skeptical outside of the Philly backup plan option for him. There's really much of a market out there because the Orlando stuff, I'm not so certain about. Definite word that the Magic are only going to be willing to offer like a 2-year balloon payment, bigger than what they did for Joe Ingles last year. But that is a data point to suggest that Orlando is willing to do such a thing. They gave Joe Ingles a 2-year, $20-ish million deal a year ago that he wasn't getting anywhere else with a team option on the second year.
But also so, 2 and 22 for Ingles, as you said, with a team option the second year, that I have to imagine is dramatically below what Klay Thompson is sort of imagining. So like, where is the middle ground on an offer like that? Which, and so this is, you know, you are a sourced reporter. I am just some fucking guy. But my guess, as all of that Magic noise started up, that what it seemed to me like was like, well, that's Klay's people trying to make sure there's a market if they don't like what Golden State's saying. And that never totally passed the smell test to me. A guy who has been so deeply tied with this organization is going to leave to go to Orlando. That never really sort of made a ton of sense to me.
And that's exactly where I was taking it, because Klay turned down a 2-year 48 or 50, whatever the exact number was, deal from Golden State before last season. I don't know if he's even getting that much from Orlando, you know what I'm saying? In a hypothetical situation. Mm-hmm. Like that Brook Lopez 2-year 46 number we talked about for Isaiah Hartenstein. After what that dude just did last year, that dude being Klay Thompson, I don't know how you could justify giving that type of deal if you are the Magic. So at this juncture, I am skeptical that there is going to be a wealth of interest for Klay on the open market. Does that play into Golden State's hands? I don't know. But right now, that's where I'm currently standing on it.
Yeah, which, I mean, divorced from context, like this is a guy who did average like 18 points a game and shot 39% from 3 on 9 a game. Like he still provides value in that role. He is not the, obviously, as we mentioned earlier, not the defensive player he was in years past. He has not, there was a lot of like, shoot to get hot, shoot to stay hot. Oh, whoops, I never got hot from Klay Thompson last season. But still somebody, you know, I think close to 600 made threes over the last two seasons. Like there's still the thing that he does a better than almost anybody in the history of the sport, he can still do. So there's still value there. And the thing that I keep coming back to, like as frustrating as the Warriors were last season, and we talked about it, the Draymond Green suspensions, the Draymond Green, you know, drama that is associated with it, the inability to kind of keep Andrew Wiggins productive, to get much out of him, the Jonathan Kuminga ups and downs as far as where he was in the pecking order and where, how much Steve Kerr trusted him and how much he trusted Steve Kerr and all that. Like, there's still, like, through all of the bullshit, in the 720 minutes that the Warriors had Stephen Curry, Draymond Green, and Klay Thompson on the floor, they were plus 81, plus 6.2 points per 100 possessions, scored like a top 10 offense, and defended like a top 5 defense.
There you go.
Like, there, it's still the it does, now that guarantees you nothing in this West, right? And we've been talking about that, like, you know, it's not just the, you know, the Mavericks making a run. There's the Thunder. There's Memphis maybe making a comeback. I shouldn't talk about that because you want to go there. There's the Spurs on the ascent with Wembanyama and whatever they wind up doing this summer. There's Denver, the defending champs, coming back. You know, we'll see. You mentioned KCP earlier. Still certainly some things that need to get shaken out there. On and on and on, where the Clippers go. But there's so many competitive good teams. Minnesota just made the conference finals and they still have their main guys together. Like, it's so densely packed and so competitive. But the fundamentals of what that team has been still more or less work when you can get everyone on the floor together. And so Yes. You'd need, I think, a compelling reason to move in a different direction. I think one of the more interesting questions in that realm is, I think ownership finds it a pretty compelling argument to say, we need to get out of the tax. We need to stop paying this much money for a team that has not made the playoffs in 3 out of the last 5 years, even if one of those years they won the title. And so if you're talking about not just getting under the apron, but getting out of the tax, that's like, we're taking a wrecking ball here. And maybe that's where the Klay Thompson exit goes. Maybe that's where the Chris Paul conversation winds up going. Maybe that's where, you know, you figure out what the, I don't imagine there's going to be a whole hell of a lot of a market for Andrew Wiggins with the money left on his deal and the play that he's had. But like, that's where you start looking at shaking time, because you just mentioned $177 million in just in tax, not even with salary, like $300 million all told to miss the playoffs. And like, if you don't see a better pathway or a pathway further up the standings, then that's where you got to start thinking about tearing it apart. But how do you do that with Stephen Curry, like, still there?
Yeah.
It's like, Mike Dunleavy Jr. took this job and I'm sure is well compensated to do it and is very happy to be doing it. But man, there's an awful lot of, you know, rakes to step on and holes in the ground behind him that he's got to start weaving his way around.
The biggest one is Chris Paul's contract.
Yes.
And I can guarantee you he's not making $30 million to play for the Warriors next year, but they have a non-guaranteed date of 6/28 that they're trying to figure out. There's been plenty of reporting out there. They could agree to push that back and give CP a little bit more guarantee to do that. That's kind of how that quid pro quo works. I think they are absolutely exploring all kinds of ways. You know, the pie in the sky options are like LeBron and Paul George on what to turn that $30 million into. Don't know if that's really a realistic outcome, but where else can they go? This is a super creative. This is a team that turned Jordan Poole into Chris Paul that we didn't see coming, you know, a week before it happened. So they're right back in that situation with him. They've got a guaranteed decision to make on Kevon Looney, which comes sooner. I believe it's June 23rd. So it's the day of the draft. Or no, excuse me. That's the Sunday before the draft. And those are the two next decision points that are going to push key critical decisions in Golden State and their optionality moving forward. So we shall see how that all unfolds. But the Warriors, to Dan's point, have not shown a keen interest in paying all that luxury tax if it's not a team they think really can compete for a title. But they still have Steph Curry playing at an MVP-type level. And while they do, I've gotten every indication that they're going to try to furnish a roster around him that they think can. It's just not going to be easy. They have one of the more interesting, like if we talk about Dallas just having to figure out the Derrick Jones thing, the Warriors have one of the more interesting front office, you know, predicaments, I think, across the league, being that they've had all the success, they have pieces in place, but not necessarily all the pieces you would want that thing could win a title in 2025. And a potentially very expensive roster if things don't go a certain way.
And once more thing before that's it, is that one thing that, you know, we just watched a team go from miss the play-in to the finals, right? But what did Dallas have that helped them do that was the 10th pick in the draft, right? The Warriors, by missing the playoffs, would have had the 14th pick in the draft. That pick is going to the Portland Trailblazers because in, what is it, five, 6 years ago at this point, that pick went to Memphis in the Andre Iguodala deal and then has wound its way around the league and now is up to the Blazers because it fell in the lottery. It was protected, I think, 5-14, and then it wound up at the Blazers. So another, like, you could add maybe if you hit a home run in the middle of the end of the lottery, you could wind up finding one of those rare avenues to, you know, dramatic shifting talent or, you know, franchise shifting talent that could boost you right back up. They are not going to have that. I don't think they pick until the very end of the second round in this draft. So what you need then is, like, all right, Brandon Pajemski, Trace Jackson Davis. Does Moses Moody finally get the opportunity to make this kind of difference? Jonathan Kuminga, you know, this is the opportunity. Like, they now are counting on dramatic improvements and you know, those guys lifting up the level to be able to meet Steph's level, to be able to get back where they want to go, and to be able to do it, you know, for a significantly less dear cost than they've been putting into the roster. And it's a tough place to be, but, you know, as you said, very creative front office, and they've got the most important thing that you need, which is number 30.
There you go. That's all I've got for you today, because I need to go blow my nose immediately. Thanks to super producer John Gennaro, who does all the things to make this show look and sound great. Please subscribe to Ball Don't Lie on YouTube or whatever podcast platform you're currently listening on, and leave us a 5-star review. We thank you for listening. We'd appreciate it. We came back again next week for another episode. No cap.